You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the people have had it. They're fed up. Occupy right now is occupying the front of the Verizon headquarters in New York City over on the West Side Highway in that neighborhood in Manhattan. And lots of people are getting fed up with all this stuff. Dennis Kucinich, former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, is one of them. He's on the line with us right now. Congressman Kucinich, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. And I should mention, KucinichAction.com is the best website for you and your adventures and exploits and whatnot these days. You had some very pointed words about the NSA the other day. Can you share that with us?
Well, you know, when I look at the scope of their activities, how they have illegally spied on Americans, how they have this wholesale approach towards gathering the most private and personal information of the American people, how they misled Congress, misled the FISA court, and perhaps even misled the White House, they have gone far beyond the Constitution. And frankly, we now have to make a choice. We either choose the Constitution or we choose the NSA, but we can't have both.
At least in its current form, I'm assuming you mean. Or are you calling for...
The NSA has to go. Listen, this is an organization that is out of control. It's gone rogue, and it's very destructive of a half a dozen cherished constitutional principles. And we cannot tolerate this. You know, to say, well, you know, yeah, somebody can make a mistake. Got that. This isn't a mistake. This is policy that they're that they've gone way beyond what they're permitted to do, and they don't get a chance to do that. There is no. When you engage in such massive violation of the rights of the American people, you don't get another chance. You're done.
So you're calling to close the NSA and for presumably the CIA or some other intelligence agency to pick up whatever legitimate
gathering. Hello, I mean, we have the CIA, the FBI, the Defense Intelligence Agency. We've got the Homeland Security. There's Interpol. There's intelligence agencies all around the world. The thing is that the NSA has become a law unto itself, and that cannot be tolerated in the USA.
So what's the process? Are you suggesting that Congress
defund it? Gone. I mean, they came close. So look, they would have defunded it for domestic purposes in the before the congressional break, except that information that would have been critical to making the decision was held from Congress. Now, this is the kind of games that go on. We can't have a viable democratic tradition upheld when you have an institution that works under the aegis or sanction of the government proceeding methodically against a half a dozen portions of the Bill of Rights and other constitutional amendments. This is intolerable. And you know, what does it mean to be an American? It's connected to personal freedom. They've invaded privacy. They've trampled on personal freedom. They've got to go, period. There is no middle ground here. There's not like, well, you know, if they only adjust their grip a little bit, maybe they'll hit the ball straight. No, they should not be permitted to operate anymore.
Well, that's quite emphatic. On reflection, I think I agree with you. So you are calling on Congress to hold another defunding vote? Would that be the essence?
They should defund the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, you know, a middle ground would be to defund any domestic activity. Mm. But it doesn't, you know, at this point, it doesn't matter. It's like they can capture information from innocent Americans anywhere in the world. They just can't be trusted.
Right.
This is the deeper question here is trust. It's trust what's hold the government together. And so we've had nothing but lies and deceptions from the NSA. And it's not compatible with the democratic tradition. We have to make a choice. Who are we as a country? What does it mean to be an American? This is the deeper question that we're faced with here. And what the NSA has done, and its active concealment, its disinformation and misinformation, in its conniving to be able to hold on to power, is to degrade and defame a democratic tradition. You don't get a chance to do that with taxpayers' funds. and you shouldn't. They shouldn't be permitted to do that.
Right.
And they've gone rogue, and they need to be wiped out.
I know you have to run here. If I may, one last quick question. The NSA, while being a creature of Congress, it's created by Congress, is within the executive branch. It's directly answerable to the president, the executive branch. What should the president do?
Well, look, David Sirota has a great article today about what the White House knew and when they knew it. The president of the United States has a responsibility here to clean house at the NSA. He can't keep coming to the American people telling us everything's okay when they keep reading in the Washington Post and other places that there's been a massive spying campaign domestically by the NSA. I mean, what a joke. To say that they didn't know the difference between the area code for Egypt and the area code for Washington, D.C. Easy to mistake to make. I dial Washington all the time, and I get Egypt. I mean, who are these guys? Who do they think they're kidding? So, you know, we have to really come to our senses and stand up for the basic principles of what it means to be an American. This isn't a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic issue. It's not a liberal issue. It's not a conservative issue. It's an issue of the truth. It's an issue of justice, an issue of our Constitution, and whether or not we're ready to stand for those principles that people gave their lives for over the last couple hundred years.
Congressman, former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, KucinichAction.com. Sir, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Bye.
A strong call from Congressman Kucinich for literally ending the NSA. You know, I have to say it makes perfect sense. You've got an institution within the government that was created by the government. You know, within our lifetimes, it certainly could be uncreated. And yet they have a multi-billion-dollar budget, 70% of which is in the hands of private corporations. How those private corporations, I mean, you know, over at Booz Allen Hamilton, where Ed Snowden used to work, which is owned by the Carlyle Group, majority-owned, which used to be partly owned by the Bin Laden family. Do you really think that the Bin Laden family and their lobbying and the Carlyle Group and their lobbying and all of the other contractors who are making some serious money off the NSA and their lobbying, that they're going to let this, you know, let Congress defund them? I don't know. You know, Congress came within 7 votes of it. But that's only, in my opinion, that's only because John Boehner made the mistake of thinking that his Republicans would vote with him. He completely misread the temperature of the room. And frankly, I think Nancy Pelosi did, too. I think she was surprised by how many Democrats voted to defund the NSA's domestic activities, domestic spying activities. And in the midst of this, they're basically building a town out in Utah. They're building a data center that's going to be bigger than, well, I don't know, it's going to be damn big. It's going to make the Library of Alexandria, you know, that'll be like the janitor's closet in this building. Comparative. I mean, it's digital, it's not paper, but you get the point. But what a great, Egypt, its country code is 20, Washington, D.C., the area code's 202. So, yeah, we just made, 2,776 mistakes or some odd number of mistakes. I'm not sure how many were mistaking Egypt for the U.S., and Congressman Kucinich says, I live in Washington, D.C., I make that mistake all the time and accidentally get Egypt. And it suddenly hit me as he said that, you know, yeah, I live in D.C. all the time. You know, I live in D.C. I make 202 calls every single day. I've been doing it for 3 years. I've never gotten somebody in Egypt. Fascinating. Should we defund the NSA? Is it time to substantially reboot the whole thing? 15 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He went on to say, in a just world, Ed Snowden would be having ticker tape parades for him, but that's not going to happen. Brilliant. It's the place where smart people get the news, the Tom Hartman Program. And, you know, in some ways, in many ways, America, the America that I live in right now in 2013 is very much not the America I remember growing up in. before Reagan, shall we say, and or before Bush. I mean, those were two revolutionary changes in my lifetime. The Reagan Revolution, which was an economic revolution that moved wealth and power to the top 1% and started systematically stripping the middle class. And then the Bush Revolution, which was a revolution in civil rights. And along the lines of that second revolution, it looks like the Obama administration thinks that your cell phone is a, quote, suspicious object, end quote, and wants to give police officers the power to search it without a warrant, whether you're arrested for jaywalking or for terrorism. This was reported in the Washington Post on Monday. The administration filed a brief with the Supreme Court earlier this summer, asking the Supreme Court to reconsider a decision made by the First Circuit Court of Appeals back in May. That case involved a Massachusetts man named Brema Worry, who was arrested in 2007 for selling crack cocaine. When the police had Worry in custody, they took one of his cell phones as well, and that phone started ringing. And when it rang, the, you know, where the little window on the phone, this was an old flip phone, where the window on the phone says, you know, who's calling, it said, my house, and the phone number. So the police wrote down the number, reverse looked it up, found out where the address was, went to that house, busted in, found weapons, drugs, and money. And so Worry, instead of just the small crime he was charged with a whole bunch of stuff and got 262 months in prison. But back in May, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, this is the one that handles the Northeast, overturned that conviction. This court said that police had violated Brema Worry's basic Fourth Amendment right to privacy when they opened his cell phone and tracked down the My House contact. In my opinion, just speaking for myself, the First Circuit Court was absolutely correct in its decision. The Fourth Amendment says this. It's one sentence long. It's really simple. It's really straightforward. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Now notice this. Papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, you know, for a search, but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. So historically, you know, the courts have said that personal computers are papers under the Fourth Amendment that require a warranted search. And frankly, because a cell phone, especially smartphones, are just personal computers, very portable ones, I think law enforcement should have to get a warrant before they can search them. But here's where things get tricky. As the Washington Post and the Volokh conspiracy blog point out, the cell phone that the Massachusetts police took from Brema Worry a little under 6 years ago was not a modern-day smartphone. It was an old flip phone, nothing like an iPhone or a Motorola Droid or whatever. And because that flip phone was so simple, it wasn't a computer, it was a phone. It's going to be a lot easier for the Obama administration to convince the Supreme Court that Worry's phone was not a complex personal computer or a collection of digital papers that required warrants, but was just a suspicious object that police were well within their right to search. You know what it looks like to me? It looks like with this appeal, the Obama administration is basically trying to weasel their way into legalizing warrantless searches of your cell phone. Now, I'd expect this kind of thing from Dick Nixon or Dick Cheney, but not the guy who spent his entire first presidential campaign bashing the Bush administration for shredding the Constitution. That would be Barack Obama. The scariest and saddest thing all this is that this Supreme Court, this Roberts Court, is so corporate friendly, so police friendly, so right-wing, that they might just buy the Obama administration's argument and legalize warrantless cell phone searches. And if so, the NSA is the least of your worries. Kiss another constitutional liberty goodbye. Amazing. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, you wanted to talk about Congressman Kucinich.
Yes, how are you, Tom? Let me cut the volume down some. Okay. Yes, sir. I just wanted to say that Mr. Kucinich is the first person who's come on the radio and told the absolute truth.
I'm starting to think so.
Say that again?
I'm starting to think so.
Oh, yeah. What the NSA, what they're doing is criminal, Tom. They're criminals. Like, you just stole my thunder. I was just sitting here reading the Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. A computer is an effect. A telephone is an effect.
Yep.
Your mail is an effect. Against unreasonable searches and seizures. It's criminal, Tom, and he's right. They should be gotten rid of. They're out of control. They should be gotten rid of. And Obama's worse than Bush when it comes to respecting the privacy of the American individual.
Well, Wayne, let's not overstate things. I don't think anything could be worse than Bush. But this is damn bad. It doesn't have to be worse than Bush to be bad. And between the criminal enterprise increasingly that looks to be called J.P. Morgan Chase and the apparently criminal enterprise that is the NSA, it's getting pretty strange here in the United States. Wayne, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's Tuesday and anything goes summer. We'll be back with more of the news of the day. Hey, did you hear about this deputy who sued a woman for mental anguish? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Fascinating little study here that just came out. Which country does it cost the most to go to college? As you know, I am a strong advocate of free college in the United States. Let's go back to the way it was before Ronald Reagan. But free college has pretty much gone the way of the dodo bird in the United States and Australia. The U.S. and Australia are the most expensive in the world. U.S. it costs, when you add the cost of living to the fees associated with college, it costs about $35,700 a year to go to college in the United States. It costs $30,000 in the UK. This is a study done by HSBC, by the way, one of the largest banks in the world. I think it's the second largest bank in the United States. And yeah, this is average cost of university fees. In Germany, it is the tuition in the United States. Here's just consider these numbers. Tuition in the United States on average is $25,226 a year, 25 grand a year. Tuition cost in Germany annually, $635 for the year. Tuition cost in Spain, $1,002 for the year. Taiwan, $3,000. China, $3,900. Russia, $3,100. Japan, $6,500. And then it starts going up from there as the, in some of the developed. Now, this study, of course, does not include those countries like Denmark and Finland and Norway and Sweden where it's free. Okay, I mentioned the deputy, and then I'm going to pick up your phone calls. The lines are slammed here. We'll get right to that. A Texas deputy has filed a lawsuit against a woman for past and future mental anguish after he was called to her house last year, David Edwards writes over at Raw Story, on a 9/11 call and was forced to kill her son-in-law, who was allegedly behaving irrationally after using drugs. Deputy shows up. The woman's son-in-law is acting nutty. The guy shoots him and kills him. The cop shoots him and kills him and then sues the woman for emotional distress. I am not making this up. Harris County Deputy Bradley Pullen, according to the Houston Chronicle. It's amazing. Corinne Padilla, who witnessed the incident, said that her brother-in-law never touched the officers and was backing away with his hands up when they shot him. At no moment did Kimmel assault the officer, she said. An unarmed man, a family guy, father and husband, three girls, was killed. He had no criminal record. He was self-employed in export-import of very expensive rugs from Turkey and Persia. Hmm. Oh, well. The news just gets stranger and stranger. The NDAA, Section 1021, destroying the 1st, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. I'll get into that in some more detail later on, but like I said, it's anything goes summer. Let's pick up your call. Steve in Erie, Colorado. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, in support of...
Steve? Hello.
And the thought that this is something new in terms of
Steve,
how
Steve, you faded out completely, and you just came back in. So say it over. Say it over again.
In support of Dennis Kucinich and his idea of defunding and doing away with the NSA, I know it brought up for me a conversation I had with my uncle who before he passed away, which was a while ago. But he had served in Western Europe in Dwight Eisenhower's headquarters as a clerk.
During World War II.
And he never really, during World War II. And he never really talked about his experiences there until just before he passed away and we had all gotten older and kind of were more involved in the political process. And what one statement that he said was that, and this is his statement, not mine, I'm just going to repeat what he told me, which was they should drop an atom bomb on the Pentagon because there's more clandestine stuff going on in that organization that no one knows anything about and has no kind of oversight. It's all going on in the background, and no one knows about it. That was his statement.
That was his statement. Now, let's be very, very clear here, particularly in this day when somebody dropped a flying bomb on the Pentagon a decade ago, that neither you nor I are endorsing anything like that. And in fact, with all these caveats, we're starting to sound like we're afraid of the police state coming after us. But the fact of the matter is, reasonably speaking,
exactly.
He was. I'm assuming he was speaking metaphorically even then.
Yes, exactly. But the point being is that the people who are behind all of this NSA kind of stuff are inherently paranoiac. That's what makes them want to be where they are.
Yeah.
And so immediately they're untrustworthy in terms of being able to accurately assess and hold.
Yeah, Steve, your phone has faded out again. This time you're gone. But I get your point. Thanks for listening, William in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, William.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Yeah, I was just chime in on what Congressman Kucinich, who I hope will be the next governor of Ohio, said. I think, like the Bill of Rights declared into force December 15th, 1791. Especially Article 4. I think it should just be torn up because, it's not enforced,
Well, then you could argue it's already been torn up.
Yeah, they can do whatever they want to do.
Yeah, then you could argue it's already been torn up. I get you that you're being sarcastic or ironic, but don't you think that this is something that is worth fighting for? Is probably the wrong phrase, metaphorically, working to preserve, restore?
Well, if you're going to restore it, something has to be done.
Yeah.
Because, it's really been just ignored.
Yeah.
I'm a man of color, and I've never had this right.
You've never had this. I'm sorry.
I never had the right. I could go down the street and I'll be stopped. I can be racial profiled while driving.
Right.
All that. Now it's coming to fruition that it's happening to all the citizens.
Right. So, in other words, as a person of color, basically you've lived your whole life feeling that the police could do whatever they wanted and take whatever they wanted. But now that it's starting to hit white folks and they're starting to yell about it, the rest of America is getting concerned. Would that be a reasonable restatement of your position?
Sure.
Yeah. I suspect that there are many people who have had your experience and grown up in the America that you grew up with who are looking at white people like me going, look at this is terrible, going, hey, wait a minute, we've been through this.
Yes, Tom, and I'm 70 years old now.
Whoa.
All my life, it's been like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you've seen it all, William. You've seen it all. William, thank you for the call. Thank you for a very, very thoughtful comment and thought-provoking comment. Cora in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Cora.
I say hooray for Denis Kucinich. You know, I'm really puzzled by the people that are so blasé about this, and I'd like to ask them to think about their little children.
Mm-hmm.
How much are our little children on the phone or on the computer?
Yeah.
They're not able to sign a contract. You know, what's the government think about little children who are not aware of this stuff and who blunder into problems all the time?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, we're making things worse for the next generations instead of making it better.
I do not disagree. And this is both an issue of government and corporate behavior. And it's something that, you know, thank God for Edward Snowden. We're having these conversations.
Right.
It's time that we start addressing these things. And Denis Kucinich has always, his entire political life, and I've known Denis Kucinich for, geez, probably 20 years. I was there with him and Marianne Williamson when they started the Department of Peace Project here in Washington, D.C. It was back in the 90s, as I recall, the early 90s. And he has always been the political equivalent of the boy who said the emperor has no clothes. You know, he's always been the one who stands up and says, who speaks truth to power, who sees what's going on with clear eyes. And well said, Cora. Cora, thank you for the call. Doug in Jamul, California. Doug, you normally call up to yell at me.
Well, Tom, guess what? You can live to hear. Well, you might still yell at you. My question was, I was going to talk about the recall of Bob Filner, but I'm listening to your listeners and talk about Denis Kucinich and Snowden. And I agree with that. I agreed with your interpretation of the Fourth Amendment, right?
Yeah, yeah. Fourth Amendment's privacy rights.
You're right on. And so is, you know, Rand Paul and Denis Kucinich is on the same page.
Yep.
And, you know, so we're in this together on that, because I believe my computer is my effect. Emails are my effect, and they should stay out of it. I mean,
yeah.
Also Snowden, I believe Snowden should get a parade. I mean, he's an absolute whistleblower.
He woke us all up. Yeah, he woke us all up. I'm with you. And, Bob, I'll sign you. You know, if I lived in San Diego, I'd sign your recall petition on Mayor Filner. You know,
That's what I want to hear, because, listen, this is what's shocking to you. I signed up to collect signatures for the recall. It was downtown in the lair of the white worm, being Bob Filner the vampire. And right by the YWCA at the Santa Fe Depot, and collecting signatures. And I didn't get one woman that was going into the YWCA or the women in there to sign the petition. I downtown, I was getting like one every four person was a felon, and some people didn't even know who the mayor was.
Yeah, it's a sad commentary on the nature of democracy in America right now, Doug. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You ever heard of Grok Law? It's another website that closed down today because the FBI wants to know who's there and what they're saying. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, you have a quote from Applebaum you wanted to share?
Yes, I saw him this morning. And
first of all, who is Applebaum?
He's right now he's in Germany, and he is a consultant to NSA and security information matters. Very brilliant guy on computer espionage and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And he writes for a few. I think he's a freelance writer.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway. I'm not really clear. Well, he was on with the guy from NSA who was arrested, and the film producer for Greenwald's film. She was a film producer for his latest show, his latest thing on NSA releases. But what he summed it up in the last minute of his discussion. And he said, and this should be shouted from the rooftops, people who were saying that I have nothing to hide, it doesn't depend on you to make that decision, what you have to hide. This is all a machine, all running through a computer, through an algorithm. If they detect something, a flag is sent up. And when that flag is sent up, they alert the FBI, and the FBI will send out two or three people to visit, to pay you a home visit at your house.
Well, maybe, maybe not. But, you know, they're going to pay attention to you. I know last week, I do my program, my TV program on the RT television network and on the Free Speech TV television network. Free Speech TV is an American nonprofit. RT is the network. It's funded in part by Russia. Our program is totally independent. We own it. But they had asked me if I would just do an interview with one of their people. And I said, sure. And the person called me at home from Moscow. So I get a call from Moscow. And then later on in the day, one of my best friends lives in Germany. And he called me from Germany. And I'm thinking, holy cow, I got a, you know, on my phone, I got a call today from Moscow. I got a phone call today from Germany. You know, we come in here. We were doing a pre-record. No, this was on TV. We were doing a pre-record with a guy who is in Turkey. He had just on the border with Syria. We're talking to him on the phone. It's like they got a that was here in the radio studio. I mean, I can't imagine what lists I'm on just from simple stuff like that, not to mention the things that I say on the air.
Exactly. You know, the thing is, you might be on a list. Maybe they haven't sent someone over to see you. Yeah. But the point he was trying to make.
Or maybe they have, and I just don't know because I haven't noticed things have been moved around inside my boat.
The security letter that no one's going to tell you under penalty of. But I remember that was it. They used to say the United States could not become a totalitarian government because of the totalitarian state because of all the freedoms we have. Look what they've done. They've eliminated a lot of those freedoms, and here we are in face-to-face with this police state. Now, I just saw something on the web the other day about Thorsten Veblen, and he was predicting this. He said with this high-tech society, what's going to happen is either you're going to have government control or the businesses are going to take over the government, and we're going to have a police state.
Yeah, and Thorsten Veblen has been dead for a couple of decades, hasn't he?
This is a rehash of what he, sort of what he wrote.
Yeah,
it was by a scholar.
Yeah,
and I can't help but think this is not. I remember the idea that we couldn't become a totalitarian state because of all these reasons,
Well, I think in some ways what has happened is that it was always there, and Ed Snowden tore the mask off, and now we're looking at the skull, going, "Holy cow, look at that." Maggots in the eyeballs kind of thing. And Thorsten Veblen, the good news about what he had to say, one of the other things that he projected back in the 40s, as I recall, 30s or 40s, was the theory of the influencer class, that if you can influence about 20% of the population, you will, within a few years and certainly within a generation, change the opinions of all of the people, or the vast majority of the people. That there's a... It's like a rudder effect, the trim tab effect. There is a small portion of the population that you can influence, and they are the influencers who influence everybody else. And once the national zeitgeist changes, it becomes almost impossible to unchange, at least for a cycle, for a period of time. And we saw that with the Reagan Revolution, the idea that greed is good and that we're not a we society, it's a me society, and, get what you can, and paying taxes is bad, and all that kind of stuff. And now we're waking up from it 30 years later. And I think, frankly, we are now waking up from 30 years or longer of just basically worshiping the national security state and the military-industrial complex. Dwight Eisenhower warned us about this in 1961. We should have listened. But I'm an optimist, Frank. I genuinely am. We'll see where this goes. But I'm still hopeful. I'm not willing to give up yet. Hal in Rumston, New Jersey. Hey, Hal, what's up?
Tom, I was listening before, and you're talking about people talking about cell phones as papers.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that you're saying that sounds more like Dick Cheney. Well, actually, a lot of the people that are working there now are holdovers from the Bush administration. So in a sense, it is Dick Cheney.
Yeah, of course. And this is one of the things that I was astounded when I learned about a year into the Obama administration that he had not asked for the resignation of all 100 U.S. federal attorneys, which Bush did, and which Clinton did, and which Bush before him did, and which Reagan did. These are people who serve their appointed positions. They serve at the pleasure of the president. And 93 of those people, went on that, looking for illegal voters witch hunt that George Bush spent 7 years on. 7 of them said, no, I'm not going to do it. I'd rather put actual criminals in jail, and Bush fired them. So we know that virtually 100% of the 100 U.S. attorneys were political hacks on the right wing, and Obama didn't get rid of them when he came into office. It blows my mind, the things that didn't get done, and that's one of them. Hal, thanks for the, you know, keeping things in perspective, but this is, once again, you know, where is the Obama administration? Why are they not attending to these things? Or do they agree with this philosophy? Is it that Obama agrees with the Bush-Cheney worldview? I think that there's a certain element. If you spend enough time around the generals and the paranoid and the powerful and the people who are making money off paranoia and power, that it's contagious. It's just contagious. Anyhow, it's just a couple of minutes before 4 o'clock here on the East Coast. We'll be back with I want to talk to you about the GOP plan to get young people to stop Obamacare.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So, remember when Sarah Palin was talking about death panels?
Obamacare has death panels.
I can't do a Sarah Palin. I'm sorry. I shouldn't even try. Jim is like, where'd that come from? I don't know. I shouldn't. I'm not Phil Hendry. Anyway, when she was going off about death panels and saying, you know, if Obamacare is going to kill people, quack, 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 we all knew where that was coming from. I mean, you know, it was about as sincere as Marcus Bachmann thinking that if he just spends enough time praying with gay people, suddenly they won't be gay anymore. But something really interesting is going on right now that I felt was important enough to share with you in the hopes that you will share it with others. Because it actually is a matter of life and death. The statistics on young people getting cancer are as follows. Among people 25 to 29 years old, it's 1 in 2,000 people. Among people 30 to 34 years old, it's 1 in 1,250 people. So, basically, if you could convince, and not everybody who gets cancer dies from cancer, but everybody who gets cancer either dies from cancer or runs up some very large medical bills. I mean, it's one or the other, and sometimes both. And sometimes running up the huge medical bills, if you don't have insurance, it's not just as bad as dying, obviously, but it will lead to an earlier death. It destroys people's lives. It ruins their ability to make a living. Stress kills. Financial stress is some of the worst there is. We've done entire shows on how, you know, during conservative governments in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia, the science is in, suicides go up. Conservatives cause people to, you know, conservative economic policies cause people to commit suicide. So, of course, you know, getting sick, and this is just cancer. Getting very, very sick and then surviving it, but having a huge medical bill is something that is going to shorten your lifespan. So you can safely say, and this is not even, counting how many young people under 35 die in car accidents or, you know, die from binge drinking or, die from Tylenol or, I mean, whatever. I mean, you know, there's lots and lots of things people die of or die from infections. It's just cancer. If you can talk 2,000 people out of getting health insurance, actually the number would be around 1,600, at least one of them in all probability, according to statistics, is going to get cancer. And they're either going to die or they're going to be broke, or both. If you could talk 10,000 people out of getting health insurance, even if it's free, if you can talk 10,000 people out of getting health insurance, you're going to kill 4 or 5 people, at least. I mean, these are just simple statistics. You don't even need Sarah Palin's level of intellect to understand this. So, Dick Armey, actually, before I get to that, so here's the challenge Republicans have. If more than 3 million people under 35 who are healthy sign up for Obamacare, then Obamacare is going to be an incredible success because those people paying into it, even though most of them are, or many of them, maybe even the majority of them, are not going to be paying with their own money. There are generous government subsidies to pay for this, paid for by a small 1% tax on the top 1%. But in any case, if 3 million people under 35 sign up for Obamacare, the program will be successful because they'll provide the base to cover the costs of the older and sicker people. And if 3 million people under 35 don't sign up for Obamacare, it will be a failure. This is the last firewall that the Republicans have, the last opportunity they have to make Barack Obama look bad, to destroy his signature legacy, to destroy Obamacare, to destroy the thing that probably, if this NSA stuff doesn't take him down the way the Vietnam War took down LBJ, probably will be the legacy that he's remembered for. I mean, the whole LBJ analogy haunts me because LBJ, looking back on it, was one of the best presidents in my lifetime. I was not alive when Franklin Roosevelt was around. LBJ was one of the best presidents in my lifetime. And yet, I spent almost every year of his presidency out in the streets protesting him, yelling, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" And just opposing his policies because Vietnam was all anybody was thinking about, at least anybody my age at that time. The Great Society was a big deal. Civil Rights Act was a big deal. The Voting Rights Act was a big deal. And perhaps in the African-American community, there was a better understanding of what a great president Lyndon Johnson was and how he had followed on the policies that John and Robert Kennedy had initiated that were so transformational. But for your basic lower middle class white kid, it was all about the Vietnam War. And I am concerned that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, people are going to look back and say, "Oh, Obama, yeah, he's the guy who was spying on us all," rather than he's the guy who brought us health insurance. But in any case, the Republicans, they tried to stop Medicare when LBJ passed it. Ronald Reagan even made a recording, a half-hour-long record that they mailed out to thousands and thousands of people. Didn't succeed. They couldn't stop it. They tried to stop Obamacare. Didn't succeed. They couldn't stop it. But they have this one last chance. If they can just talk young people into not signing up, it will fail. And so here comes Dick Armey with this ad from his so-called Freedom Works group, heavily funded by the Koch brothers. But Dick Armey himself is a multimillionaire. Here's the ad.
In a few short months, Obamacare is set to take effect. Families and small businesses across the country are wondering, what will it mean for them? ABC News says confusion and doubt are prognosis for Obamacare. And NBC News said even doctors are skeptical and confused about Obamacare.
Oh, my!
People like Julie, a mother of three, have questions.
Yes. 2 years ago, my son Caleb began having seizures. The medical care he received meant the world to me. Now, I'm paying more attention, and I have some questions about Obamacare. If we can't pick our own doctor, how do I know my family's going to get the care they need? And what am I getting in exchange for higher premiums and a smaller paycheck? Can I really trust the folks in Washington with my family's health care? I think we all deserve some answers.
To get answers about what Obamacare means for your family, please go to ObamacareRiskFactors.com. That's ObamacareRiskFactors.com.
So, paid for by Freedom Works at the very end, yeah. So, poor Julie here, they've got her to go on on radio nationwide and say she's got a son with a pre-existing condition and she's worried about Obamacare. Now, Obamacare prevents the insurance companies from kicking her kid off the insurance policy. And then she says, and how am I going to do this with higher premiums and a lower paycheck? Well, you're not going to have either. You're going to have lower premiums and a higher paycheck. So she and FreedomWorks are promulgating lies. Now, why would they do that? Well, she probably did it because she was paid and she doesn't know better. But FreedomWorks certainly knows better. The reason they're doing it is they're trying to prevent young people from signing up so that Obamacare will fail. And in the process of preventing those young people from signing up, they are causing people to die. These people are stone-cold killers.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dick Armey, the Koch brothers, the funders of this campaign to kill Obamacare are stone-cold killers. It's Talk Media for the Sane Among Us, the Tom Hartman Program. And anything goes summer, Howard, in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Oh, too many subjects, Tom.
Let's start with government-financed elections. Is that what you mentioned to Danielle?
Yeah, but a quickie before that. I think that all Democrats ought to tell their Republican friends that Ted Cruz was born not in Canada, but Kenya.
Right.
This... And when they respond, no, Canada, you say, well, what's the difference?
Exactly. Well, the difference is that Ted Cruz is the white guy. I mean, this is, and you can say, oh, his father was Cuban, he's Hispanic. No, no, no. He's, you know, take a look at him. He's the white guy. And all these Tea Partiers who were so hysterical that President Obama might have been born in Kenya, even if he was, his mother's a U.S. citizen, he's a U.S. citizen, right? Ted Cruz was born in Canada. His father was Cuban. His father was a foreigner, just like Obama's father was a foreigner. Except that, and Ted Cruz was born outside the United States, and he released his birth certificate to prove it. And yeah, I have not heard one Tea Partier say, I won't vote for Ted Cruz because he's not legitimate to be the president.
Well, anyway, let me get to my main subject before
sir.
I lose time. The other thing is, I've got to say this. You've got the guys to do this. Why don't you take that ad that you just ran on Obamacare and tear it apart and rerun it?
Yeah,
refuting everyone.
Well, I did tear it apart afterwards.
That's what the Democrats lack. We don't kick ass back.
Yeah,
we let them lie and don't do anything about it.
I thought I talked back to it, Howard. What did I miss?
No, but we got to put an ad out now.
Oh, I see. You mean turn it into something and then somehow magically come up with the $5 or $10 million that Dick Armey's got and put it on radio stations all over the country.
Well, we'll have to work on it.
Yeah.
But anyway, the big point, this is the salvation of the country. And, I mean, it's not a new subject. It's voter-financed or government-financed elections.
Sure.
By having that, we get rid of the corporations. And we've got the ammunition to do it because anyone who doesn't want to go along with it has to say, no, 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 I want my corporation to support me.
Here's the problem. Both Arizona and Maine put together very good public financing laws that caused those two states to suddenly, this was back about a decade and a half ago, suddenly have the highest percentage of average everything from, you know, housewife, homemaker on the one hand to, you know, truck driver, you know, basically blue collar workers. To have the highest percentage of basically those kind of folks, people who aren't working in the workforce at all, people who have been raising kids, or people who are at the low end of the workforce, to have the highest percentage of those kind of folks in their state legislatures and their state senates in the nation, and because average people could run for political office, they didn't have to raise money. Those laws made it possible. The corporations and the billionaires took those before the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court said, sorry, can't do that. You can't have a publicly financed system where a billionaire can't buy their way in and beat the bejesus out of you. And because both those states said, if you're a billionaire and you're trying to compete with somebody who's state-funded, you can't do it. And the billionaires came in and said, that's a violation of our right to free speech, and money, after all, is the same thing as speech under the First Amendment. And so you've got to let us billionaires be able to buy elections. And so now Arizona and Maine are back to where they, you know, they've gone back to Crazyville somewhat. and Arizona's firmly in Republican control, and Maine has got, you know, Mr. LePage, who only got 37% of the vote, but still, you know, it was a three-way race, and so he's the governor, and you've got Republicans in the, I believe they control both houses, I could be wrong, but...
Well, to pass additional law with this...
That no, you can't get around the Supreme Court. Howard, we live in a constitutional monarchy. We've got nine kings and queens sitting three blocks from me right here in Washington, D.C., and they decide what the laws of this land are, not you and me, not our elected representatives, and not our president. It is not what the founders intended. It is not what the Constitution says. They invented this doctrine. John Marshall, Chief Justice John Marshall, the U.S. Supreme Court in 1803 invented this doctrine called judicial review, that the Supreme Court gets to have the final say in all law. It is, as I said, not in the Constitution. In fact, the Constitution says the opposite. It says that the Supreme Court shall operate under regulations defined by Congress. It puts Congress in charge of the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court has put themselves in charge of Congress, and the Supreme Court has decided it's billionaires' rules. And the only way around that is to amend the Constitution.
43 states, and we say that anybody who contributes to an election other than the government goes to jail for 5 years.
Yeah.
There's an amendment.
Yeah, 34 states is what it would take, but I think. Isn't it? Yeah. It's four, or maybe it's 43. It's four-fifths of the states?
No. I think it is 34, 38,
yeah.
Something.
Yeah, yeah. You're talking about an Article 5 constitutional amendment.
Fourth, yeah. An amendment saying anybody contributing to an election goes to jail for 5 years.
That would be very interesting.
The government.
I think that you could do that much more simply by passing the MoveToAmend.org amendment, which says corporations aren't people and money is not speech. As soon as that becomes law, Congress then has the power to pass laws which say, billionaires, if you try to buy an election, you go to jail. Corporations, if you try to buy a politician, it's called bribery, you go to jail. And frankly, I can tell you from living in this town, there are a few Republicans who just love living the fat cat life. You know, the Tom DeLays of the Republican Party, they love hanging out with the billionaires, the Paul Ryans of the Republican Party. But they are actually the minority in the Republican Party, and they are almost non-existent in the Democratic Party. And so you would see, once they had the legal authority to overturn the power of billionaires and the power of corporations, particularly transnational corporations in this country, you would see a bipartisan Congress rush to the podium to pass that legislation. It would happen
yeah.
that fast. The only thing that's preventing it is the Supreme Court, and the way around that, like I said, is to go to MoveToAmend.org, join the movement, sign up, open a local chapter, get those two things in the amendment. Any politician who comes out and says, I'm just going to roll back Citizens United, say that's not enough. In addition to rolling back Citizens United, you have to go the whole way. You have to say corporations are not people and money is not speech under the Constitution. And when we do that, we will get our country back. Howard, thanks for the call. And it's 27 minutes past the hour, coming up on 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more here on the program where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman program. Other than a little despair for Dick Armey.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, poor Dick. The only way he can destroy Obama's legacy is to ask young people to die. And he's actually spending money to do that. Well, you've welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Neither is General Electric. Okay, you have heard my complaints about President Obama. I have a lot of respect and admiration for President Obama. He's done a lot of good things. He's a lot of progressive legislation was accomplished. He's said many good things and important things that need to be said. I think he has been an extraordinary leader in many ways in this country. And I think he's dropped the ball in the Fourth Amendment in a big way. So that's my complaint. The Republican governor of Maine, however, has a different complaint about the president. He had a room full of supporters last week, two of whom have now come forward and told the Portland Press Herald, one of the newspapers in that state, that at this fundraiser, here's Governor LePage, he's in a room full of rich white people, asking them for money, something, you know, Republicans do a lot of, sit in a room with rich white people and ask for money. And he said, the president is a bad president because he hates white people. I'm not making this up. This is, you know, two of the rich people who were there have told the main Portland Press Herald that Maine Governor Paul LePage, R, Republican Crackpotville. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you'd expect from Limbaugh or Beck or something like that. But this is the governor, by the way, who, when he was invited to participate in a NAACP event, told the NAACP to, quote, kiss my butt, end quote. He said the new Democratic budget was equivalent to anal rape. He vowed to repeal Maine's child labor laws. He refuses to talk to three of the state's newspapers because he doesn't like the way they've characterized his words accurately. Amazing. It's just incredible. Nate, who was on a little earlier on our show, he's a producer with The Big Picture. He used to live in Maine. And he said there are people who drive around Maine with a bumper sticker that just says 37%. I was like, what's that? And he said it was a three-way race for governor, a Democrat, a progressive, and Paul LePage. He got 37% of the vote. And it's the same exact same thing happened in Vermont when I was living in Vermont. We had a Republican governor for 4 years, 6 years maybe. And it was because there was a progressive party and the Democratic Party, and they between the two of them, they took well over half the vote. But the Republican got more than either one of the others alone, which is why we need instant runoff voting. So anyhow, and speaking of Vermont, the sequestration is cutting into what's called Section 8 housing. Section 8 housing is housing support for people who are just genuinely down out of, on their luck, just flat out, bottom of the barrel, just scraping by. You know, here's a place to live, right? Sequestration is cutting $2 billion out of low income housing assistance this year, and just in the state of Vermont. And I think Vermont's a great place to use as an example because it's a small state. There's not a lot of people there, and very often when people say Section 8 housing, what immediately comes to mind, at least in the minds of white people, is black people. And there's not that many black people in Vermont, so these are probably all going to be white people. 2,000 people are going to be thrown out on the streets. They're going to become homeless because of sequestration. It's like the caller who called earlier who said, you know, words to the effect of, you know, now that white people are being spied on by the government, it's become a national scandal. You know, African Americans have been spied on by the government from day one. I mean, look at what they did to Martin Luther King. Speaking of race or nationality, Ted Cruz. Yes, Ted Cruz, United States Senator, Republican from Canada. Yes, seriously, Ted Cruz. This is O Canada in the background, their national anthem. Ted Cruz is a Canadian citizen, and like many of the Dreamers, remember this? When Obama came out with the Dreamers program, he says, you know, let's take these people who came here in the United States as 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, never learned anything except English, or they learned English and Spanish, but they've always thought they were Americans. Their parents didn't inform them that they weren't. Many of these people discovered that they weren't here in this country legally, that they weren't legal citizens when they tried to get into college. And they try to get state assistance, and you got to show your birth certificate. No, I don't have one. Or my birth certificate says Juarez, or whatever. And many of these Dreamers said, and I remember, you know, Limbaugh and all these other right-wingers ridiculing it. Many of the Dreamers said, I just didn't realize I was not a U.S. citizen until I was, you know, in a position where I had to get a driver's license or apply for student loan or something like that, and then I discovered. I didn't even know until then. Well, here's what Ted Cruz said yesterday. Ted Cruz. His dad was Cuban, and Ted Cruz was born in Canada, right? He was born in Calgary. And he said, quote, assuming this is true, then sure, I will renounce my Canadian citizenship. Nothing against Canada, but I'm an American by birth, and as a U.S. senator, I believe I should be only an American because I was a U.S. citizen at birth, because I left Calgary when I was four, and I've lived my entire life in the U.S., and because I've never taken affirmative steps to claim Canadian citizenship, I assumed that was the end of the matter. There you go. That's quite all right, Shano. See, poor Ted Cruz, he had, you know, Ted Cruz had no idea. Sean says if Ted Cruz keeps his Canadian citizenship, she may have to renounce hers. Okay. So our producer's been outed now. No, we've talked about that before. And we're proud to have a Canadian working on this program. But this is just hysterical. The guy who hates dreamers is a dreamer, it appears. Anyway, George in Albert Lea, Minnesota. George, you want to stick up for the billionaires and the corporations? Really?
No, I'm just asking what are you afraid of? What is there to fear from billionaires and corporations?
I share Thomas Jefferson's concern that with great wealth comes great political power, and with great political power concentrated in the hands of a small minority of the population, democracy does not work the way it's supposed to.
Yeah, but what can they do to you?
They can ruin my country.
How?
Well, for one thing, they can cause Congress to pass legislation that gives them half of the budget every year as the military-industrial complex, and they can make fortunes and buy mansions, and that money is not available to this country to do reasonable things like building infrastructure and bridges and hospitals and schools. They can lobby really, really hard and run ads and things to destroy our education system and promote things like voucherized education so that they and their buddies can make money on what should be the public trust. They can, I mean, you really want a list?
No, well, it sounds like you're making a case for a smaller government, because if government, what you're talking about is them taking control of at least part of what the power that government has taken upon itself to use it for their ends.
You're right. I had this conversation with Ron Paul last night for a half hour, and here's what Ron Paul said. He said, A, the government should not be regulating things because the regulation should be via the courts. And I said, so how do, say the Koch brothers have a refinery in Texas, which they do, and I happen to live downwind from it, and it is, you know, one of my kids has cancer or it's polluting my air or whatever, and I don't like that. What should I be able to do? And he said, well, you know, they should not specifically them, but he said, you know, people who pollute, that's dumping your trash in somebody else's backyard. That should not be allowed. And so if you are the victim of pollution, if there's an externality, if ExxonMobil, the example I was using actually was ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers. And I said, you know, they're dumping the costs of the cancers and the global warming from the production, you know, from burning fossil fuels on us. They're causing all of us to pay for it. They're dumping that externality on us. And Ron Paul said they shouldn't be able to, and you and I should be able to sue them to recover the externality, the garbage, the cost of their garbage being dumped in our backyard or in our lungs. And the point that I made, and I didn't make it very well in my conversation with former Congressman Paul last night because we just basically ran out of time, but the point that I would make, and I will make right now, is that the same people who are using Ron Paul and libertarian philosophy to say we shouldn't have regulation, for what you correctly point out is a very good reason, are also saying that we have to have tort reform. We have to limit the amount that a person can sue to $250,000 like they've done in Texas. We have to tie the hands of individuals. That there was this wonderful thing when the Supreme Court the other day said people can't join together in class actions against large corporations. In other words, they want to have the one side, the no regulation, but they don't want to have the other side. They can be held accountable. So, yeah, I'm with you. If we lived in Ron Paul's world where you and I could push back against the billionaires when they buy government, then we wouldn't need as much government. I'm with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But see, that's the libertarian scam. And it's, you know, philosophically, it's wonderful. But the scam part is that they don't tell you that the courts should be strong. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Bob in Marseilles, Illinois. Bob, hey, thanks for listening to WCPT.
Yeah, and I want to go back a topic or two. I called in to comment on the Justice Department and the fact that that Obama didn't turn over the people that serve at his bequest. And I don't think that's all of the problem. The bigger part of the problem is when Bush was in office, it's a little bit like the state legislatures going down the road with the ALEC people. When Bush was in office, it was the civil servants in the Justice Department that got switched out. And they're untouchable to a certain extent, and they probably should be untouchable. It's a little bit like tenure with a teacher.
Right.
But Bush made a point, and the Republicans are a lot smarter than we give them credit for.
Or a lot more evil.
Both, definitely both. And probably you're more evil, more so even than intelligent. But what Bush did was he changed out all of the civil service people in the Justice Department, and whenever a position came open, it wasn't only a political hack, it was a religiously motivated political hack from the Liberty U law school.
Right. Jerry Falwell's college.
Exactly. They don't associate Liberty University with the law school. It's got a different name, probably for PR purposes, because Liberty U, among people like you and me, might automatically hit a button.
Yeah.
But basically, that's what Bush did, and there was nothing at all Obama could have done to overturn that. But like you say, if he'd have probably been better off throwing everybody out, not just in the Justice Department, but places like the NSA and the CIA and a whole bunch of other places.
Yeah, I think he made the same mistake when he came into office that Bill Clinton did, and that's that he took the advice of the quote establishment moderates, end quote. In Bill Clinton's case, it was people like Larry Summers and Robert Rubin. And frankly, apparently in Barack Obama's case, it was people like Larry Summers and Robert Rubin. And these people do not have America's best interests at heart. They are looking out for their own best interests and their class's best interests and economic class. And that's not, I think, a healthy thing. Bob, thanks. Excellent point. Thanks for calling and making it. Sergio, in Toronto, Canada, you have a question that a Canadian would like to ask an American?
Absolutely. I'm from Toronto, Canada, and I hear a lot this Obamacare will not work because, like, whereas the GOPs are afraid that Obamacare could work. In Canada, OHIP is basically given to you. When my poor mother died of cancer, she had all treatments. We never saw a penny of expense. But if she were in the States, we lose our house and the shirt off our back. Yep. Why don't you, as American people, ask, can we have free medical care undiscriminate for all of us?
Well, a lot of us have been asking that for a long time, Sergio, and the answer to why we can't is because there are a number of people who are making millions, hundreds of millions, and even billions. I mean, for example, the largest health insurance company in the United States, I believe, is United Healthcare. The CEO of that company, Stephen Hemsley, has taken over $1 billion, with a B, over $1 billion in compensation from that company. The guy who preceded him, Dollar Bill McGuire, took over $1.6 billion in compensation from that company. He was accused of fraud and stock manipulation and had to give back a couple hundred million, but, you know, kept the rest of it. These guys are untouchable. They're rich. They're powerful. They buy politicians. They buy media. They buy think tanks. And they have the average American bamboozled. The average American actually believes, Sergio, that Canadians like yourself, when you get sick, if it's a serious illness, like you said your mother had cancer, that you are desperately trying to figure out how to get across the U.S. border to get down here for this incredible health care we have here. What are your thoughts on that?
Do you know what? The Canadian health care is basically second to none. As I said, we never saw an expense. You walk in and out of the doctor's office, flash the card, thank you very much, bye-bye. But in the States, when we were there in 82, my mother felt something sick, and we had to bring her to see some doctor. Wow, the expense was just incredible.
Yeah. So you're not desperate to get to the United States for health care because Canadian care is so bad.
That's the last thing I'd want.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for clearing that up and for educating our American listeners, because I'm telling you, every day there is some right-wing talk show host someplace in America who's saying, oh, those Canadians, they're just desperate to get over to the United States. And I keep saying, you know, I lived in Detroit. I grew up in Michigan, and Louise and I lived in Vermont for 10 years, in both cases within 100 miles of the Canadian border, and I never saw Canadians in our healthcare system. But I do remember, and when we lived in Vermont, the elderly Americans lining up to get on the bus in downtown Burlington to go up to Montreal to get their pharmaceuticals. And in fact, Senator Sanders was organizing that back when he was Congressman Sanders. So, Sergio, thanks a lot for the call. I love it. Thanks for what you had to say. John in Minneapolis. John, a minute to the break. It's yours.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, I think as far as the national security state, it is an incredibly powerful, you know, part of the government. And who knows what is said or not said and what they indicate to a president as to what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. Because I do think that they're not really that free to make a lot of these kinds of decisions.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's not a lot of political capital either. Because I think a lot of people aren't really that interested. It doesn't impact, or they don't perceive that it impacts their life that greatly. Mm-hmm. If, you know, some journalist is being harassed.
Do you think that maybe the national security machine has something on President Obama that they're basically blackmailing him with, the way Hoover used to do?
No, I don't think that. I think that, you know, they just say, hey, look, you know, if you want to live to see, you know, this nice, you know, retirement years and your children safe and whatnot, that's what I really...
Oh, so it's like the mob. Yeah. Huh, amazing. John, thank you for the call. I'm not going to tell you that you're wrong. I don't think I can.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, would you like to... Actually, let me rephrase that. How would you feel... Welcome back to the third hour of our program, by the way. How would you feel... And special greetings to our listeners on KPFK in Los Angeles who are listening to us live right now. How would you feel if you were sitting in a restaurant or a bar or... espresso shop or a record store or a yoga center, and somebody walked in with a AR-14 slung over their shoulder with a 20-round clip in it or even a, you know, 38 caliber pistol on their hip in clear sight, not wearing a police officer's uniform or anything, just dressed like, you know, your average serial killer. How would you feel? Would you want to patronize that place? And if you owned that place, would you maybe think that having such kind of folks hanging around a lot might be bad for business, and therefore you might want to sign on to Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn's and the Washington Ceasefire Board President Ralph Fasatelli's voluntary program in which city businesses sign up to be gun-free zones? So far, the Five Point Cafe, Barboza, Big Mario's Pizza, Brent Haven, Bus Stop Espresso, Cafe Polona, Cafe Razor, Cafe Century Ballroom, Elliott Bay Books. Hey, where I've done a number of book signings. Good on you, Elliott Bay Books. First Janet Methodist Church, Fish Fry, Freddy's Jr., Havana, Linda's, Lost Lake Cafe and Lounge, Manhattan, Seattle, Mo Bar, all six locations of Molly Moon's, Numo's, Noob Green, Odd Fellows Office, Nomads, Platinum Records, Quinn's, Smith's, South Southern Street Kids, Sweatbox Yoga, The Saint, Toto, Kalo, and Zoe have all said, okay, we are becoming gun-free zones. Now, this has Neil McCabe really concerned. He's a conservative commentator, editor of the Guns and Patriots newsletter for Human Events. Website, Neil W. McCabe, MCCABE.com. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Hey, great to be with you, Tom. I just want to, before we go into it, I just want to tell your listeners that they can ask their parents or grandparents what a record store is.
Yes. Okay. You wonder if the, you know, I haven't been in one in a long time. You wonder if nowadays you walk in with your iPhone or whatever, you know, your electronic device, and they've got a place where you just plug it in and they download the song to you.
Well, that was the plan that Circuit City wanted back in the 90s before the Clinton Justice Department at the behest of the record industry shut it down.
Oh, that's interesting. Huh. Okay. Well, without getting into the weirdities of our copyright and trademark laws, why do you think that I should be forced to tolerate the guy sitting next to me, either on the one hand blowing cigarette smoke in my face or on the other hand, you know, threatening me or just by his simple presence with a deadly weapon?
Well, first of all, I don't think everybody carrying a gun is a serial killer or looks like a serial killer.
What do serial killers look like?
Obvious. I don't know, but I mean, just throw that out there.
Most serial killers look just like everybody else. Ted Bundy, nice clean cut guy.
Well, of course, the other thing is that obviously, if a private business or private property owner wants to control access, I think they have every right to do that, and I would support their right. If somebody doesn't want to make money off of gun owners or people carrying weapons, then really that's up to him. I mean, this is a commercial republic, as set out by Madison, and so God bless. Of course,
more Hamilton actually.
It's Federalist 10. But the thing is, guns make people safer, and certainly we know that spree killers avoid places where people will have guns, and they look for gun-free zones. Gun-free zones are places where people are, you know, helpless victims.
So, first of all, I that premise has been so trounced, you know, this trying to claim that killers go into school. Killers go to school because it's going to be the places where they're going to do the most horrific damage because they've got something mentally wrong with them. The schools that killers have gone into where there were armed guards, the armed guards were not successful at stopping them. And so it doesn't matter gun-free zone or not a gun-free zone. That is a straw man, Neil, and you know that. But setting that argument aside, if we can, why?
Let's just move on. I don't want to dwell on it. Go ahead.
Sure. Okay. Why do you object to this? Or is it that we don't have a debate here? That you're agreeing with me that if people don't want to sit next to somebody with a gun, or if a business owner feels that people with guns are bad for business, that they have every right to say out of here.
And I think so. And I think there's a lot of things that are handled basically by, you know, private individuals making decisions. I don't think we need a mayor or a governor or a president making these sort of decisions from on high.
This is a totally voluntary program.
The places in Seattle don't want to have guns, then they can say, listen, we don't want to sell to you. Go away.
Yeah, this is a totally voluntary program. All the city provides, as far as I can tell, is a sign. I'm not even sure they provide the sign, actually, because when I look at the sign, it looks like it says school zone. So that's probably.
Of course, the danger is that you're communicating the wrong message to people. The idea that guns somehow make things less safe, when actually guns make things safer, and in fact, guns even make people politer.
They make them more frightened, Do you think that being frightened and being polite are the same thing?
Well, it can be, Tom.
I always thought being polite was being considerate. I thought, you know, when I'm polite to people, it's typically because I like them, not because I'm afraid of them. The people that have power over me that I am polite to, I'm polite. You know, a police officer pulls me over, for example. Not that I'm quaking in my boots, but I know that if I, you know, play or TSA somebody at the airport, you know, if I start making bomb jokes, I know what's going to happen, and it's not going to be pleasant. And
no,
so,
no, we're talking about an escalation. You just don't have the same escalations when people are armed. And it's not so much, you know, with concealed carry, a lot of, you know, the spree shooter doesn't, or the robber or the criminal doesn't really know who has a gun and who doesn't have a gun. So a lot of times they'll just avoid an area or a community where they know there'll be gun owners or gun people carrying, just like their neighborhoods, you know, where if you know there's a certain neighborhood that there's a high percentage of gun ownerships among those residents, you'll break into a house somewhere else.
Well, it's a nice theory, Neil, but, you know, most spree shooters are actually suicidal. Their goal is to kill, is to die. When that, you know, the guy who shot Gabby Giffords, there were two people with guns in that crowd. He was hoping to die. Harris and Klebold, they wanted to die. Most of these people are committing a variation on suicide by cop, and they're taking down a lot of people with them.
It's the second part that you said. It's the care. They want to take out as many. They want to take out people before they execute that suicide, whether it's by themselves or by the cops. And so when you have people who are armed, they don't have the opportunity to have those.
I don't think that's true. I think that if somebody is, I think Newtown demonstrated that.
If shoot back, they'll stop you, right?
No, I think the Newtown demonstrated that. If somebody's determined to get in, if they're determined to kill people, you're not going to, even an armed guard is not going to stop them. The first person they'll shoot is the armed guard.
Newtown had zero expectation of someone armed there.
Newtown is not the best example for an armed guard, but it was a lockdown place. There was, you know, the electronic doors and all this kind of stuff. It was supposed to be secure. But you would think that if the guy who did the shooting in Newtown, if there had been an armed guard there, first person he would have killed would have been the armed guard. Come on, Neil.
Well, the armed guard would have taken him down in 30 seconds. End of story.
I don't think history demonstrates that. But we'll leave you with the last word on that, sort of, I guess. Neil McCabe, neilwmccabe.com. Thank you, Neil.
Great to be with
you. Always good talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can read Neil's column over at Human Events and neilwmccabe.com. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Verity in Addison, Illinois. Hey, Verity, you want to talk about biosociology and politics?
Yes, I do, Tom. Because I hear a lot of people call into talk shows and say that the politicians or political groups they disapprove of are crazy.
Right.
I don't think so. I think a lot of the stuff that makes no sense at all if you believe someone's stated ideology makes perfect sense if you reframe their behavior as pro, a, or anti-social. There's a local guy here that says politics is all about who gets what and who pays.
Right.
Well, funny enough, so is ecological biology.
But wait a second. Pro-social, asocial, and anti-social.
Correct.
Let's define terms.
Pro-social are mutualists. People who profit by contributing to the common good. They work together for mutual benefit.
Okay. Asocial?
Okay. Asocial are commensals. These are the neutral gleaners and scavengers who profit from the commons but don't cause any harm.
Okay. And then the antisocial?
They are the predators and parasites, individuals who profit by harming others, usually by depriving others of resources.
It sounds kind of like you've described this is wild overgeneralization, of course, but the Democratic Party, the non-affiliated voter, and the Republican Party.
You're not that far from the truth.
Okay.
Although I have to add a little finesse on that, in that predators and parasites are going to change their coats depending on where the money and the power are.
Right.
Here in Illinois, they're wearing blue shirts.
Yeah, of course.
So there are strong biological contributions to each of these resource acquiring styles, you know, such as, you know, are you more empathetic, are you less empathetic, are you more gregarious, are you not? But there's an equally strong contribution from culture in humans because so much of our survival strategies are learned.
Mm-hmm.
And as you rightly point out very often, since the influence of, well, I'm going to say the Chicago School of Classical Economics on Reagan and Thatcher,
sure,
the United States has adopted a culture of sociopathy, of predatory and predacious and parasitic behavior.
Yeah, predatory laissez-faire capitalism.
Exactly right.
Yes.
New studies in neuroeconomics, though, show that most humans are actually mutualists.
Yes.
Like, if you go online and search the ultimatum game, the dictator game, you'll find out that most people would rather share equally in something than rip somebody off like Homo economicus tells us to do.
That's correct.
And the way
we
learn sociopathy, I think we can unlearn it, but laws are not enough.
Well, that's been my point. That's been my point about the Reagan Revolution, that what the Reagan Revolution did was they elevated a sociopathic worldview. Greed is good. If everybody operates to the maximum of their own benefit, it will somehow magically transform into a maximum benefit for all of society. They elevated that to a religion. They got enough people to buy into it. They hit that tipping point. Enough people bought into it. People of goodwill. That even the people who, you know, it ultimately was really, they were really economically shooting themselves in the foot. The Archie Bunker Democrats, I call them. They started buying into all this stuff. And then, you know, the Republicans were able to create a large enough coalition by adding single issue slices, the anti-abortion people, the pro-gun people, the bigots, the homophobes. I mean, you name it, that they put together a governing coalition. But the fragility of this, which is, I think, becoming more and more apparent every single day, is that it is fundamentally based on a lie. It's based on an assumption of human behavior, which is not true of the vast majority of humans. It's an assumption of human behavior, the sociopathic perspective, that is only true of a very small percentage of humans.
Exactly right. And I think we need to use social controls to do that. I mean, like, we have been giving rich people all the prestige and stuff, I want that turned around. I want pro-social behavior to get the prestige. I want us to look at rich people and assume, as does the adage, that behind many a great fortune is a great crime.
Mm-hmm.
We need to treat these people as if they are de facto criminals. If you live an ostentatiously wealthy lifestyle, you need to be looked at as if you're a public drunk, as if you just barfed all over yourself.
Mm-hmm.
We need to treat them with the stink eye, the way we do smokers in public, for Pete's sake. Look at how we turned around smoking behavior.
Yep. Verity, have you read Krista Freeland's book, Plutocrats?
No, not yet, no.
You're going to love it. She opens this book with the story of a party in the 1920s, as I recall. No, it was the 1890s, in a party in New York City, where this very, very wealthy family threw a birthday party or a wedding party or something like that was so ostentatious. It was like, you know, the guests got like diamond rings sort of things. I mean, you know, people were like drinking drinks that had diamonds in them, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's not the actual example, but it's that kind of thing. And they thought at that point in time, it was the end of the robber baron era, and there was this growing discontent because the robber baron era, the 1880s, 1890s, up to around 1900, was the time of the worst poverty in the history of the United States, the most grinding, horrific poverty, and the most conspicuous wealth. And this party was the thing that flipped. It was the turning point. It was the tipping point. It was the thing that flipped on the Progressive Revolution. It so upset New Yorkers, and thus, that being the media center of America, the rest of the country, that it was the beginning of the end of the plutocrats and kicked off and, you know, led to in 1913 the direct election of senators, the imposition of the income tax, led to in 1920 the right to vote for women, led to, you know, all these progressive reforms, both at the state and federal level, because it was that tipping point. And I think we are so close to that right now.
I absolutely agree. We need to just make sure that we pound it home to these people that this antisocial predatory behavior is not acceptable. We will no longer tolerate it.
Yeah, I'm completely with you. Shano, who selects all these things says that you are the person that he wants to give a book to today, one of my books. Would you rather have Cracking the Code, Screwed, or Rebooting the American Dream?
Oh, my gosh. Pick one.
Okay.
I'd be happy for any of them.
Okay, I'll let Danielle and you figure it out, okay? Hang on just a minute, Verity. I'm going to put you on hold, and Danielle will get your address, and we'll send you an autographed copy of one of my books here. Just because that was such a great call. Thank you, Verity, and thanks for listening to WCPT.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how long is it going to be? Using Verity's frame, how long is it going to be before America wakes up to the sociopaths in our midst and pushes back? Good, the bad, and the very, very gallinaciously ugly, the good. Former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, the Ohio former congressman, blasted the NSA at a recent showing of the documentary Terms and Conditions May Apply. Check this out.
Frankly, I think it's time to, and I'm saying this with a lifetime experience in government, I think it's time to punch the NSA's ticket here. They've ruined the brand. They've destroyed the idea of privacy, and we need some kind of symbolic and actually profound approach here that says, look, you violated something that's very dear to the American people. You don't get to do that for government agencies that so broadly betray the public interest. There needs to be a measure of responsibility, and if they go beyond the pale, which the NSA has, they just ought to be abolished.
A congressman should be commended for his passionate defense of civil liberties. While abolishing the NSA in its entirety might be hard to do, we need to have an open discussion about the power of unaccountable intelligence agencies in our country, in our democracy, and if that includes questioning the need for the NSA, then so be it. The bad. Governor Paul LePage, the Republican governor of Maine, has made a name for himself during his time in office with his, direct way of talking and his opposition to all things Obama. But LePage's latest brash comments are outrageous even by his own standards. According to a Monday report, the Portland Press-Herald, the governor told a crowd of supporters at a Republican fundraiser last week that, quote, President Obama hates white people, end quote. Not only is Governor LePage's remark a disturbing example of Tea Party race baiting at its very worst, it's also wildly inaccurate. In case you forgot, President Obama is half white. His mother was white. The grandparents who raised him and who he considers heroes were both white. I mean, come on. And the very, very ugly Extel Development Company. New York City real estate firm finds itself in hot water today in the wake of news reports that a mixed-income apartment complex it's planning to build in Manhattan will have two separate entrances, one for wealthy residents, the other for poor ones. Naturally, the poor people's entrance will be in a back alley. According to Extel, keeping poor apartment dwellers apart from rich ones is a logical way to follow zoning laws and, of course, to save a few million dollars in taxes. But let's be honest, Extel's laughable excuse making aside, this separate but equal real estate plan is just very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. All righty. Mark, listening in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on Minnesota's Progressive Voice, KTNF. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Tom, thanks for taking the call. I wanted to let you know that I think that what you do is not only very important, but also very well done.
Thank you.
Two things I want to talk about. One is United Health Group, the second single payer from Canada. You had mentioned prior CEO McGuire walking away with $1.6 billion in stock options.
Well, it wasn't all stock options, but yeah.
There's a follow-up to that, that he was sued by the shareholders and returned about $700 million of that. Now,
yeah, I said that, only I thought I was $300 million, but yeah, you're right. Go ahead.
What do you think if you or I walked away from a fiduciary relationship with $300 million that didn't belong to us?
I think we'd be in prison.
The second point, the caller from Canada, very interesting to hear his comments. I've traveled a bit up in Canada. I've looked at the single-payer system. I think that's where we started when Obama started his first term talking about healthcare, was some concept of single-payer.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of it. I think that we need to sell this idea to conservatives, and this is how I sell it to the conservatives that I talk to about this. Conservatives hate the idea of anybody getting a free ride in our society. Mm. So what you talk about is in Canada, the people who go to the hospital, the people who smoke tobacco, chew tobacco, drink beer, they are paying $17 a pack for cigarettes, $42 a case for beer, and it's a pay-as-you-go system. Hmm. Now, this money goes into to take care of the health care cost. But right. A lot of the conservatives love this idea. They think, well, if somebody's on welfare and they're spending their money on tobacco, they get to chip in too.
Yeah. So people who are basically living a risky lifestyle are prepaying the cost of treatment for it.
Yes, it's certainly not free. Everybody understands that. And it doesn't really matter what your socioeconomic background is. If you're doing things that are going to bring you to the hospital, you're going to be chipping in as you go.
Yeah. I mean, there's a very small piece of that in Obamacare and the tanning bed tax, because tanning beds are known to cause skin cancer, and skin cancer is on the rise, and it's expensive, and it kills people occasionally, and in fact, more often than occasionally. So
I really believe that we need single payer in this country. The doctors that I've talked to that fight with United Health Group about getting paid, they want single payer too, a lot of them.
Yeah.
And so I think that if we just reframe the discussion in terms of, you know, everybody's interested in their own little agenda, we got to reframe this for conservatives. They might back it.
Yeah, you might be. You might be right. Mark, I think that what's going to happen is we're going to see the Canadian experience repeated here, only in slow motion. In Canada, when Saskatchewan went single payer, all the other provinces were like, oh, yeah, right. And then, you know, a year or two down the road, everybody's going, whoa, this really works well. And now, you know, every single province has it. They're all administered at the province level, at what we would call the state level, with some federal oversight and subsidies. And I think that when Vermont in 2014 or 2016, depending on whether they're successful in getting a waiver, and Montana maybe, but Vermont for sure, goes single payer, that, you know, within a year or two after that, you're going to see the states just start falling like dominoes. But, you know, time will tell.
I think you're right. Two other points to back that. Canada's going to have a balanced budget next year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not breaking their back to do it this way.
Right.
And the vets that we have in this country, for everybody who says that the federal government or the state governments cannot run a health care system, you ask a vet if he wants to trade his benefits at the VA hospital and go into the market that we're going to go into. Not a chance.
The biggest problem that they have right now is that George Bush started a war and created thousands and thousands of people who need very, very intensive services without commensurately planning for that in terms of the VA hospital system and the processing. So there's now, you know, this long wait and thousands of people caught in the backlogs. But it, once you get into the system, by and large, what I'm hearing from people is, actually, TRICARE has the highest satisfaction level in the United States of all the health insurance programs. The second highest is Social Security or is Medicare. And then, you know, the third and fourth or something else. And then you get down to, you know, private for-profit health insurance. So, yeah, right. Mark, thank you for the call. Very well said. Tom in Holyoke, Colorado. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, yes, I've talked to you before, but I would like to talk to you now about the XL Power Company. We had 12 different groups try to start wind farms, and we paid people for the footprint of the transmission towers, and we had to buy the wind towers, and we had everything all set up. We had to work with XL for the regulators and the capacitors when the wind don't blow. And before the contractor would start with the power transmission line, he said, we need a piece of paper saying that we can hook into the grid. Right. We thought, no problem. We've been working with them. Went to XL. They said, sorry, we've changed our minds. We're only going to work with big energy companies.
Really?
So then we went to solar. Started putting in solar, right. And so they come up and said, you can only produce 2% above your monthly average usage. And people that was concerned about our world, because it's the only one we got, mm-hmm. Well, they went ahead and just let it go at 2% for being paid and put the solar in.
Right.
And now Xcel come out with a policy, anyone producing over 2% is going to be penalized.
Now, is Xcel a, first of all, the we and the, or the people that you're talking about, this group of people, are these the good citizens of Holyoke, Colorado, or is this a neighborhood, or, you know, who all are you who are doing this?
Well, yeah, it was a group of people that started Northeast Wind, and we had...
So you started an electric co-op.
We had to go through their hoops of putting up towers for 2 years.
Wow.
We got Class 4 Wind.
Wow.
And...
Okay, now, is Xcel a for-profit electric company?
Yes.
Oh, of course. So now might be a good time to start talking to your local elected officials about eminent domain. And this company has demonstrated that they're not operating in the public interest, and about half of all electricity in the United States that is produced or transmitted is done so by public utilities. Your town or your county can take ownership, can just walk in and say, eminent domain, you are not operating in the public interest. We are taking this power company. We're going to run it as a public utility.
Well, I thought it was.
Well, no, it's not. If it's a for-profit, is it a REA? Is it a Rural Electric Association? Is it a for?
Well, it starts out that way when on the solar because we have to put it up on the district.
No, you're doing a cooperative, but is the Xcel company that you're having to interact with is treating you badly? Is that a pure for-profit corporation?
As far as I know, yes.
Yeah, well, see, yeah. They are vulnerable to eminent domain. Now, it's going to be a hell of a hard fight to fight, but you might want to consider taking him on. You also might want to consider, I don't know if he would be the guy to talk to about this, but Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org, Thomas Lindsay. He's out in Pennsylvania. You might want to check out his website, give him a call and tell him I sent you. CELDF, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That's CELDF, CELDF.org, Thomas Lindsay, CEL, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. We'll be right back. Occupying the media. Every day, right here on the Tom Hartman Program, Wendy in Vernal, Utah. Hey, Wendy, you want to disagree with
Hi.
An earlier caller about rich people?
Well, I wasn't exactly sure what she meant, first off. Did she mean that it's better and easier for everybody to be pretty much on the same level financially?
You're talking about the woman who called and talked about pro-social, asocial, and antisocial folks? No, she was not talking about economics. She was talking about the way people's brains are wired. That there are some people that the vast majority of us, in fact, the vast majority of all mammals, and humans are mammals, are social animals, and our primary instinct is to help each other and to collaborate and cooperate. And then there's a small number of us who are more of the scavengers types who tend to be loners and just kind of look out for what dropped off the table of everybody else. And then there's a small group of us who are actual predators who will destroy other people's lives in order to get what they want. And
okay, I totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah. And once we understand that, you know, people are wired in these ways, then some of their political behavior and economic behavior starts to make more sense. Okay.
Right, exactly. Yep, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Wendy. I appreciate the call. Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. How you doing, my friend?
Hey, Professors Louise and Tom Hartman, my mentors and inspiration.
Well, thank you.
And I was going over what JFK said. He said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
Right.
Is that right?
That was in his first inaugural address, as I recall.
And I thought, you know, I thought, I want to rewrite that in my own words, but what do you think about this? There is a time that our rights must be pushed and a time other rights need be used in name of democracy for civilization to be just.
That's a marvelous sentiment, Sam. And are you the captain of your neighborhood watch?
Yes. And I'm one block from the high school.
Whoa.
And I'm one block out of the city limits.
Uh-huh.
And I had a run-in with some Detroit drug dealers and some Dayton drug dealers.
Holy cow.
I'm from Columbus.
Well, people.
And I had to be very careful because there's so many children around here and youth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was threatened.
Oh, my. Well, that's not good.
Yes, sir.
That's not good. But you're not walking around like George Zimmerman with a gun in your back pocket.
No.
Okay, good.
Of course not.
Okay.
Because, I mean, yes, I have weapons. I let them know I had weapons.
Mm-hmm.
But I told them, you know, if I had to, I would use them.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally got them busted.
Yeah. But you called the police.
We had problems with the sheriff. The state police came in and got them.
Yeah.
And this has been 07.
Yeah, okay.
And they called me the sheriff of Burdett Edition.
That's great. Sam, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for staying up with us. Or keeping us up with how you're doing. Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. You know, on the whole gun thing, it occurred to me that this country was settled because they stopped allowing everybody to have guns in town. That in Dodge City, you had to check your guns at the town line.
Not just Dodge City, most cities in the Old West.
Yes, most cities in the Old West did not allow guns.
That's correct.
And I don't know about you, what experience you've had with the police, but the police that I know, when they've got a guy who's kind of gung-ho and all gunny and all this kind of stuff, and this is a few years back, they call him a cowboy.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to start doing is, for these people that are so gun-conscious, I'm going to tell them they're a cowboy, and if they're a cowboy, they check their gun at the county line and they don't come in.
There you go. Okay. A great idea, Carol. Thanks for calling and sharing it. Pete in Tyler, Texas. Hey, Pete.
Hi, Tom. I was just thinking that Ted Cruz is born of an American mother in Canada, which makes him an American citizen, but it also has dual citizenship. But, you know, his father was a Cuban. Doesn't that make him a Cuban citizen also? And is he going to renounce his Cuban citizenship?
Oh, that's a good question. Actually, that one might get him some votes. He's trying to pitch himself as a Hispanic. But Ted Cruz. There we go. Yes, oh, Canada. Ted Cruz, we'll see which one of his citizenships he's renouncing. And why is it that the birthers are all upset about Obama maybe having a Kenyan, certainly having a Kenyan father, maybe being born in Kenya when Ted Cruz was born in Canada? And, hey, it's no problem. Well, you know, isn't this just showing the racism of the Tea Party? Jason in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I heard one of these guys that's an attorney for the whistleblowers in regards to Benghazi people about a week ago on the radio, and he was talking about the fact that this whole Benghazi thing is missing 400 surface-to-air missiles, and the CIA is running around giving people polygraphs because they don't want it to get out. Have you heard anything about this?
No, I haven't, but I think we all know that there was a large CIA operation in Benghazi, that there's more to this story than any of us know, and that, you know, and that the pathetic attempts to politicize it by Daryl Issa have probably made the situation far worse. Dale in Harmony, North Carolina. Hey, Dale, last minute of the show. It's yours.
Hey, we need toxicity and the use of sulfur in processing food products.
Mm-hmm.
And it's poisoned our cows, all of it and everything. And we need to get an investigative journalist to do a real turnkey investigation.
Sulfuric acid is being used, what, in factory farms, you mean?
No, it's being used to seep grain in to break the starch down in it. Traces that sulfuric acid is left in byproducts that's left for animal feed, and I think there's traces of it in the human process, the end of it, too.
Interesting. Okay, Dale, well, you put the call out. Maybe an investigative journalist is listening. Thanks for calling. Thanks for watching the show. Coming up tomorrow, the latest news and information. Plus, what is food? It's a basic human necessity, or is it an entitlement? What? I'll have a rumble with conservative Peter Ferrara of the Carlson Center for Public Policy Research. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It genuinely does require your participation. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.